Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
P4 is what we consider the the exceptional drought. So it's the kind of the worst drought category. And to break out of a drought, it really depends on its intensity and also duration.
Talks about getting out of drought. That's Brad Pugh, a meteorologist with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center.
Short-term drought may be broken after a few weeks of beneficial precipitation, while a long-term drought, you know, could require an entire wet season. And even if that long-term drought is broken out of or ameliorated, some of those long-term drought impacts, such as low reservoirs and ecological impacts, may linger for years to come.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yeah, that has been a hot spot for drought over the past couple of decades.
Brad Pugh is a meteorologist with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, on the Southwest being a drought magnet.
We did, though, have back in 2019, so 3 years ago, there was very little drought across the country, but that that changed over the Southwest during the 2020 monsoon season. It was a very dry monsoon, some areas a record dry monsoon. So that kind of kicked off the drought there in the Southwest. And that's been followed by two consecutive La Nina winters, which are typically dry and warm across the Southwest. So, yeah, kind of those factors have really led to multi-year drought there over the Southwest.
Talks about the longer-term forecast.
That's one of our outlooks at the Climate Prediction Center, is a seasonal drought outlook. And the most recent seasonal drought outlook runs through the end of September. And it does call for improving drought conditions for Arizona and New Mexico. And that's related to wet climatology during the next few months, July, August, September. Three wettest months are one of the wettest times of the year there for Arizona and New Mexico. And also we're kind of favoring above normal precipitation during that three-month time period. So that's some reason for a little bit of optimism, although, as I mentioned before, the longer-term impacts may persist beyond the end of September.
Talks about how forecasters use historical perspectives.
In our seasonal outlooks, we do look at analogs depending on what the state of the ocean is. ENSO is very, El Nino, La Nina are very, very important factors in our seasonal temperature and precipitation outlooks. But yes, how that influences the evolution of drought and sort of both the development and also the improvement of drought conditions. For example, typically during La Nina winters, we do see an increase in drought coverage across the country, especially across the southern tier of the country. It tends to be dry and warm during the winter and spring months.
Talks about staying up to date on predictions.
If you go to the U.S. Drought Monitor webpage hosted by the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska, they actually have a very informative tutorial on kind of the process of how the map is made, at some of the indicators. So, yeah, it's very, very helpful tutorial on their webpage.
Says don't be surprised to see some new hot spots appearing.
Currently, we're seeing a drought rapidly develop over parts of the central U.S., but some of that has been it looks like it may be peaking a little bit. We've had some heavy rain in the past couple of days. This would be July 5th and 6th over parts of the Central Plains, Western Corn Belt. And they have some heavy rain ongoing there. So might be kind of peaking with the rapid onset of drought for the Corn Belt. And it looks like the focus for rapidly developing drought over the next 1 to 2 weeks would be Arkansas and southern Missouri.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm going to start with a quote, actually, from a colleague, Alan Gray from Purdue University as well. Productivity is the name of the game for most of us. Continuous improvement is about doing 10 things 1% better, not one thing 10% better.
Steven Peterson is a district manager in Wisconsin for Syngenta on the economics of agronomics.
Now, as we look at how we do production, everybody wants to produce more. Everybody wants to produce for less cost. But we have this dynamic of you have fixed costs and you have your variable costs. How do we maximize what we have for our revenue to make sure that we are producing the highest revenue and return on investment as we go forward? Dr. Allen progresses and he goes on to state, we can't make good input decisions if we don't know cost per bushel. Spending additional money always appears to raise costs when we look at it on a per acre basis. But if we ignore yield inputs, higher yielding inputs may be overlooked because we're only focused on the cost side of the business. Again, looking at the variable costs versus the fixed costs, and I think we're going to have a good discussion here later today about what that actually entails and what that means. So again, to reference, fixed costs would include your machinery, land, insurance, interest, and so on. And your variable costs would include things such as your seed, fertilizer, and chemicals, which includes about 40%, and the other one's about 60%. Dr. Gray goes on, and he states this. He says, those fixed costs benefit from improvement in productivity. The more bushels we can produce, the more we can take those fixed costs and spread them over those bushels, reducing the fixed costs per bushel. As we look over the last numerous years, you can see that the productivity gap is definitely smaller now than it was in the past. You look at from 1996 all the way through about 2006 or so, you had an opportunity to make money if you didn't even do some of the right decisions along the process. But as we've gotten into the last decade or so, those opportunities for profit have diminished and gotten smaller and smaller. Therefore, the small choices that we make have a big impact on how we are profitable on our farm, or maybe we're not profitable on our farm. The same goes for soybeans and looking at the break-even gap. The difference between making money and not making money can be just a couple key decisions. Ultimately, it starts with smart planning. Season-long opportunities, strategic, long-term thinking, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. Some people call those SMART objectives. And the next thing is the custom agronomic solutions, utilizing our trusted agronomic advisor network, whether it be a retailer or our crop consultants that are knowing our local area for our local crops and our local problems. And finally, a broad portfolio of products with a wide range, whether it be low-cost inputs, maybe some higher-cost inputs, but looking at that long range. And the other range, looking at early season all the way through till the end of the season. There's inputs that we have to be able to maximize and utilize throughout the whole season. This leads us into the next key thing that we'll talk about. And it goes into robust roots, ultimately hold more water, cleaner and greener leaves, capture more light, and ultimately healthier stocks provide a better harvest for what we have to be able to put into the bin. So growers must use all the resources and all the industry experts to maximize the plant's production and yield. And this ultimately starts with understanding the cycle of the plant development, whether it's from start, middle, to the end.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
With, you know, limited well capacities, and again, just it's so dry. Meeting those water needs is going to be tough.
Dr. Ed Barnes is Senior Director of Ag and Environmental Research with Cotton Incorporated.
In West Texas there, Jim Burdowski was a long time ag engineer, did some really, you know, groundbreaking work on understanding how to manage water in cotton, you know, and he showed pretty conclusively that a lot of pre-watering is not a good use of that water. So, you got to have water to get the crop out of the ground, but trying to bank it, he's demonstrated over many years that that's just not a good way to go. You really want to save that water for when the crop's up, when you're starting to get squares and flowers on it. That's when you're going to get the biggest return on your investment. So that's one, you know, kind of easy thing. And then it gets, you know, more challenging as the crop gets up and you start thinking, okay, when do I put that next irrigation out? And so there are a lot of tools out there. And if you'll bear with me, I'll call out Cotton Cultivated again, just so people can find some of those tools. If you go to that website, you'll see at the pretty close to the top of the page, as you scroll a little bit down, there's a button called Production. And you click on Production, and then it'll bring up kind of the different protection steps during the year. And one of those is water management. And so you click on water management, and that's going to pull up a lot of the water management resources around the country. You can even go one step further, and if you want to filter it down to the region, you can filter it down, say you're in the Southwest, you can filter it down so you only get, you know, kind of information relative to the Southwest. So that's a tool that I would encourage people to take a look at.
Barnes also talks about resources on the web.
Cottoncultivated.cottoninc.com, or just Google Cotton Cultivated, and it'll get you there. And once you get into that water management section, there, you know, for a lot of the Southwest, there's going to be, and hopefully many people are aware of this, but there's a Texas ET network, and this, there'll be a link to that site that will Texas A&M maintains, where you can find different weather stations in the Texas area that will kind of give a sense of how much ET is occurring or how much water is evaporating or potentially could evaporate. And then there's also a link, and I have kind of a fond memories of this, Oklahoma Mesonet, which give away my age a little bit, but I was working at Oklahoma State when they were finishing up that Mesonet, and that's a weather station in every county. And so that's a really great resource, and they have an irrigation planner that's available there. So there's a lot of specific scheduling resources. Another one we're working on that won't come up under the Southwest page because we're still kind of refining it for the Southwest. But we do have it linked in with Oklahoma Mesonet, and that's a smart irrigation app for your phone that, again, will be under that water management tab. And that can be – that's in both the Apple Store and the Android Play Store. So it gives you a way to get, you know, kind of predictions of what's the water status in your exact field.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The drought situation continues to be very widespread, and in some parts of the country, this is the second or third year of drought, so we've got lots of issues.
Oklahoma State University livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
In terms of the cattle on feed situation, you know, that last cattle on feed report, we did finally see a decrease in placements, actually a little bit more than the pre-report estimates had. But it's really been a long time coming. We've sort of been anticipating that placements would begin to drop for the last several months. And one of the reasons they haven't, I think, is partly due to the drought situation. If you look at heifer slaughter so far this year, so the number of heifers coming through the feedlots, heifer slaughter is up about 3.5% year over year in the first half of the year, while steer slaughter is down. And we expect the combined steer and heifer slaughter to be down in the second half of the year. But I think drought has been redirecting some of those heifers through the feedlots, and that's one of the things that's kind of postponed, if you will, seeing some tighter numbers in that situation. Of course, the other part of the drought situation that is very much an issue this year has been the beef cow culling. Beef cow slaughter is up nearly 15%. It's 14.5% above year-ago levels. And that's on top of a 9% increase year over year in cow slaughter last year. So we're clearly, when you look at more heifers coming through the feedlots, that means we're not saving them for breeding purposes. Heifer retention is down. Cow culling is up. That means we're liquidating the herd. And I think we are seeing significant beef cow herd liquidation. And again, of course, that's putting more cows in the market and more meat in the market, also adding to beef production in the short run.
And what do long-term impacts look like?
We're going to see some fairly dramatic impacts because I think this drought is probably pushing us lower than we would have gone otherwise. We were already in a degree of herd liquidation since the peak in 2019, mm-hmm. but this is pushing us significantly lower. And so at some point in time, we're going to see a more dramatic decrease in beef production once these feedlot numbers sort of work through the system. And so that's going to have impacts. And then at some point, I think we are probably going lower than we intend to be, which means there's going to be a more dramatic push to rebuild the herd. That means we'll save a lot of heifers for retention. That'll squeeze feedlot production and beef production in the short run. And we'll also cut back on cow culling when we do that. Now, that probably won't happen. The timing is tricky, but it probably won't happen even in 2023. It might be 2024 before we get there. But that's going to come as a result of what's happening to us right now in 2022.
He admits there are reflections of 2011, 2012.
We've been in a constant state of turmoil. And so we've got an underlying cattle cycle. And then when you lay these kind of issues on there, this is a little bit like what happened to the beef industry in 2011 and 2012. We had severe drought in the Southern Plains, actually, that pushed cow numbers lower than we intended to be. And of course, there was a fairly dramatic market response after that. I think we may see something like that at some point in the future.
So a lot of that focused on Q1 and Q2, but what about the second half of the year?
We've sort of talked about the fact that we're kind of waiting to sort of turn the corner really at the feedlot level in terms of feedlot numbers. That'll translate into what happens to beef production. We're expecting, both fed cattle slaughter and beef production to decline for the year, but it's going to have to happen in the second half of the year because we really haven't seen it so far. So I think we're looking for these supply fundamentals to get a little bit tighter. Prices are higher now than they were this time last year across the board for feeder cattle and fed cattle. And I think the trend will be for a continuation of these stronger cattle prices in general through the last half of this year and on into 2023.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Really starts with maximizing what we do with our strong root development and seed treatments.
Stephen Peterson is a district manager for Syngenta in Wisconsin on how healthy plants provide a positive ROI.
A strong seed treatment gives us an opportunity to be able to provide an even stand establishment, and which then therefore allows us to have an even herbicide application, allows us to be able to fight off diseases, and also keeps soil moisture in the soil, making sure that we have an opportunity for late season stress mitigation. And finally, it reduces nutrient loss, which allows us to be able to maximize our nutrient, our NPK and other micronutrients that we have and the costs that go into that. Ultimately, eliminating weed competition helps plants maximize their potential. And ultimately, as we look at this chart up here, what you're looking at is that we've got a corn plant, and this is just a scenario, but a corn plant that is competing against other weeds. And we know that early in the season, that corn plant is determining, is it having to compete, or is it able to grow naturally and therefore maximize its production? If it does have to compete, what ends up happening is that that corn plant or other plants will shoot up and grow taller to try to compete, and also the leaves will grow wider to try to compete the competitive weeds that are in the field. So the early stages determine what will happen to that corn plant throughout the rest of the season. Finally, as a result of that, what happens is there's less root development, therefore a longer season, and less nutrients that can be put into what drives yield, which is ultimately the kernels. So all these things come together, and it takes away from the opportunity for a crop to be able to produce at its maximum potential. So utilizing a strong herbicide program allows us to be able to have greater consistency, enhanced control, and long, season-long lasting residual. Weeds compete for moisture, nutrients, and light, and using a strong, robust, effective, multiple site of action product allows us to be able to have lots of different ways that we can compete. So ultimately, we talked about where the roots are and what needs to happen there. Now moving into a weed side of the fence, we talked about how do we maximize that length of residual? How do we reduce the weed population? I want to have one key stat, or actually three. I'm going to tell you three. The 3-1-3 principle. 3-inch weeds take 1-inch water every 3 days. That's a lot of water, especially in the time that we have right now of the lack of it. Water hemp will produce over 100,000 seeds and will last over 7 to 10 years in the soil and still be viable. Palm amaranth will produce over 500,000 seeds and be viable up to 6 years, maybe longer. All these things are contributing factors in which we need to make sure we maximize the residual and think about the cost per day of control that we are bringing to the field. Now, moving from the weed side of the fence to a little bit higher in the crop with the fungicide or disease tolerance, I want to think and I want you to latch on to two key words, cleaner and greener. Now, what does that mean? Cleaner, free of disease, gives us an opportunity to have cleaner leaves, therefore cleaner ears on our crop plant. Greener gives us an opportunity to see a healthier plant. So plant health benefits allow us to be able to expand the amount of nutrition that we are seeing in our plant and actually maximize.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, you would think if we were talking SEC, it'd be, you know, what the Big Ten schools worry about on Saturdays in the fall. But unfortunately, it's not football or sports related. It is the Security and Exchange Commission.
Andrew Walmsley is Senior Director of Government Affairs with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
They're focused on Wall Street, and unfortunately, they've kind of veered over to Main Street and impacting the potential businesses of both farmers and ranchers. They have a proposed rule around climate disclosure that goes much further than what you would traditionally think SEC would like information on. And those are those companies that are registrants, those large companies, you know, that are regulated by the SEC. This proposed rulemaking is looking at their emissions and their climate risk. And there's three different scopes when you talk about different greenhouse gas emissions. Scope one and two are things that companies traditionally can control. It's their emissions. A lot of them report this voluntarily. Scope two is kind of their energy usage. That's, once again, nothing too complicated. But what the SEC has proposed here and what's the real problem is scope three. And that reaches down into their value chain. And so you think for most farmers and ranchers, pretty much everything we produce outside of, you know, direct-to-consumer type sales is probably going to get in the hands of a pretty large company that's regulated by the SEC. And so this regulation is really going to put a lot of pressure and push down from these companies onto farmers and ranchers.
And under that proposed rule, farmers wouldn't directly deal with the SEC.
There's probably a smaller segment of the shareholder community that's really calling for this information. But like with most things, you know, there's a bit of activism tied to it and really intense vocal minority that wants some of this information. And I think some companies are going to be very concerned on potential liabilities tied to this rule. And so what will that requirement, because of that concern, be pushed onto farmers and ranchers? That's where we have concern, is that these companies are going to ask for information from farmers and ranchers that, A, we either don't have, or B, we don't know where to turn to. And a lot of these companies have teams of compliance officers or lawyers that keep them straight. We know that's not the case in agriculture. You know, and then there's other concerns, you know, is if we were to get this data in a way that didn't put us out of business, you know, what then is out there to protect our privacy? We're a very unique industry. We're the majority, 98% of farms and ranches in this country are family owned, and then we tend to live there. We're one of the few businesses where you actually live and raise your children at your place of business. So what type of location privacies that are going to be protected in there? The rule doesn't really address those. And then finally, it's just liabilities, right? What happens when an audit takes place? What happens if one company reports one way and a different company reports another way? Who's going to ultimately be the referee? It's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of cost we see baked into this rule, and that's what causes us such concern.
And if you really want to learn more, Walmsley says,
FBE.org. You can also link to a lot of our social media channels there. We've got our market intel service that provides weekly updates on different issues. And you're absolutely right. We're not just living through a black swan events. It's like a flock of black swans here recently. You know, look, farmers and ranchers are focused on providing the food, feed, fuel, and fiber that not only this country needs, but around the world. You know, they shouldn't really be having to worry about a rule, again, from an agency that doesn't know agriculture, that's focused on Wall Street, you know, right in the middle as we starting to get rolling and planning. You look at the geopolitical events, you look at the supply chain challenges, the inflation, cost for consumers, cost for inputs. And we've got enough to say grace over and got a big job to do it. And so hopefully SEC will take into account these concerns and hopefully get away from a misguided rule.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
One of the farm news headlines we saw on Tuesday was this one. Will favorable weather trigger a bearish corn market because of an increasingly favorable weather forecast for corn? USDA meteorologist Brad Bippy says he can't forecast the markets. No, only the weather. And after days of incredible heat over much of the country.
Fortunately, that weather is not going to last.
And Bippy says the high pressure dome causing that heat's about to break down a bit, being hit by a series of cold fronts. And in the wake of those,
we are looking at some significant rainfall. It's going to be falling through much of the Midwest and into the Mid-Atlantic over the next several days.
With the chance of rain every evening from now into the weekend.
It could total 2 to 4 inches or more, stretching from, say, Iowa and portions of neighboring states all the way eastward to the Mid-Atlantic coast.
Taking the mercury down out of the super hot range, coming at a perfect time, too.
As corn and soybeans enter reproduction across the Midwest.
But the heat will likely continue in the South and Mid-South. Gary Crawford, Washington.